Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer and we got a great cast for you tonight. My guests are both the co-founders behind the studio Double Damage Games and part of the original team who formed Runic Games. At this moment, they have recently released the popular ARPG slash open space game known as Rebel Galaxy, and we're going to be talking about that along with ARPG design tonight. So, please welcome to the cast, Eric Schaefer and Travis Baldry.
Hi there.
Hello, Josh.
Hey, guys. It's great to have you on tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Yep. Before we get going, definitely congratulations for Rebel Galaxy. I know it's been a few weeks since the game has came out. So far, I've seen a lot of great reviews. I did a whole campaign run on the YouTube channel, and it's definitely been getting some high marks all around.
Yeah, thanks. We're finally relaxing a little bit here, but it was crazy for a while, but feeling good.
Yep, definitely, Eric. You know, it's definitely a crazy time all around. For those of you listening, we are currently in the midst of the big Patreon campaign push for the site to get that much-needed monthly funding. We'll be talking more about that at the end of the cast, but yeah, we're getting close to the end of the year, and everyone is just trying to get all that work done before the big 2016. So, to get things rolling then, as I just said for you folks listening, you guys were part of both Runic Games and now you're the co-founders of Double Damage. So, for people who haven't heard of either studio or yourselves, could you talk a little bit about your background in the game industry?
You want to go first, Eric?
Sure, I'll start. I'm Eric Schaefer. I have been in the industry since 91, maybe, pretty long ago. Mm-hmm. I guess my biggest, I started when I founded a company called Condor mm-hmm. Inc., that later became Blizzard North. And mm-hmm. as such, I was the designer and one of the team leads on Diablo and Diablo 2. After that, I went, quit Blizzard after they bought our company out. Mm-hmm. That worked for about 5 years. And then went on to found a company called Flagship Studios. Flagship made the ill-fated Hellgate London.
Yes, I've heard of that.
So there was, it wasn't all bad though, because I did meet Travis. We hired Travis to do a game called Mythos for us. I'll let him talk more about that one. Okay. After Flagship crashed and burned, not Travis's fault. We started again, and the team that Travis was working on and put together the idea for Runic Games. At Runic, we made Torchlight and Torchlight 2. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing ARPGs for a long time. Travis and I, well, we can get into that in a bit, but then we left amicably Runic. My brother is still the CEO there, and made Rebel Galaxy. So that's my career in a real quick nutshell.
Cool.
All right, so I'm Travis. I guess I've been in the industry since maybe 97, somewhere thereabouts. I initially worked for Wild Tangent long, long, long ago. I think it was like the fourth employee or something, mm-hmm. where I made a bunch of games that no one's ever heard of, because a lot of them ended up being built on like a platform that doesn't even exist anymore. But ultimately, what I was known for there was the game Fate, which was just all my own stuff. And Fate did pretty well, and you know, it was kind of like a little scrappy little ARPG as far as that goes. But that's how I ended up eventually coming to work with Eric. I had worked with Phil Schenk, who was the character lead on Diablo 2, I believe, because he worked for Wild Tangent for a period of time. And so I knew him, and we were doing some stuff kind of between us for fun. And I actually interviewed at Flagship and was going to go to work at Flagship, but my wife did not really want to move to San Francisco, and we had like a 3-month-old. Mm-hmm. So instead, a few months later, I ended up working remotely for Flagship Studios on Mythos, which Eric already mentioned, which was, again, another ARPG. And we worked on that while Hellgate was going on. It was initially supposed to be kind of a canary in the mineshaft project for Hellgate, mm-hmm. where it would test out the network infrastructure that they were having to build. And it would be a free game. Mm-hmm. And then with the ultimate dissolution of Flagship and the loss of Mythos, as Eric mentioned, we just took the team who all worked well together and had been making ARPGs for a while, and popped over, made Runic Games, where we did Torchlight and Torchlight 2. And after 7 odd years of that, I got tired of organizing things and telling other people what to do and being in meetings, and wanted to get back to doing smaller development, a lot like what I used to do and a lot like what Eric used to do. And Eric said, hey, me too. So we left amicably, as Eric mentioned, and started Double Damage. And then I guess 18 months later, here we are.
Impressive. And I had no idea that you guys worked on Mythos and you did that, because I remember those games too. When I was looking both of you guys up, I know I followed you guys as far back as Torchlight, but I know that you also worked on Hellgate, and that in itself, that would be an amazing conversation to have. Well, I'm sure we could spend a good hour and a half talking about that game and everything that went on with there.
But, I'm not sure I want to, but yeah, there's a lot of material
there. Yes. But very interesting. So correct me if I'm wrong, but with Double Damage, is it just the two of you right now working at the studio?
Yep. Eric's in San Francisco and I'm in Seattle.
Cool. It's kind of interesting about, speaking about both your backgrounds and moving from different studios and different positions in the industry, it's kind of interesting about how different studios operate today compared to 10, 15 years ago. Thanks to the rise of, you know, broadband, internet connectivity and all that, especially with easier development tools, it's far easier for a small group, especially just two guys, to make impressive games today than was even possible, again, maybe even like 5, 6 years ago. It's just quite incredible. And again, I get to feel old along with you guys, because I remember playing the original Diablo and remember looking at Hellgate and even Mythos. I still remember hearing Wild Tangent too back in the day.
The tools and everything have made it a lot easier. You could make a game with two or three people back in the day, but it wouldn't look like a real game.
Talking with a lot of developers on these podcasts, I've spoken to other groups of maybe 2-3 people who can put together very impressive games. And it still is the time of the indie developers, with just how great it is to get in. But then again, there's also the trials and tribulations of going out on your own.
Yeah. It helps to have done things for, I mean, it's nice to be in a position where we've been doing work, you know, more or less like this. I mean, obviously this game is really different than stuff that we've done prior, but we've been doing this for a long time now, which makes starting on a project less scary, I think, than it is if you're doing it for the first time or out of school, or you're just for the first time you're leaving your job where you work kind of as a small cog in a big machine and like, I'm going to go make my own project now. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as scary for us given the way that we've developed in the past.
Yeah. And good point, Travis, about that. I mean, bless you.
Sorry, excuse me.
Oh, no, that's okay. I also have allergies. I'm allergic to basically outdoors at this point. I have both my mom and my dad's allergies plus some of my own. So I know.
Well, I got the little kid plague because, you know, it's the start of school. My kids go to school and then they come back. And at the inauguration of every school year, every parent gets all of the plagues of all the other children. So last week was my sick week.
Yeah, and during the summer, it was like one of the worst allergy seasons imaginable, and I had to do all the podcasts. So pretty much I sounded, my voice was like completely hoarse, like 20 minutes into each cast. But you made a really good point, Travis, about going into the studio with Double Damage and previously with Runic Games having the ARPG design experience. And the genre itself is a fascinating one. We're going to talk more about some of the details of it later in the cast. But it's definitely one of those genres where we've seen a lot of people attempt to make them, and there's definitely a very broad line between a successful ARPG and one that doesn't work. And we've seen so many great examples. Probably right now, the current king of the hill, it's still, I would arguably say, Diablo 3, just in terms of all the support and all the growth they've managed to get out of the game since its original release.
Yeah, they've continued to dump tons of energy into it.
Yeah. And Eric, please remind me, when you worked at Blizzard North, did you also work on Diablo 2 back in the day?
Yeah, Diablo 1, I was a designer, and I did all the background art and the interface art, Diablo 2, we had grown a lot bigger, and I just became the art director. Later, mm-hmm. I passed off some of those chores, too. And the designer, I guess, co-team lead with David Brevik. So, yeah, we did the Diablo 1 and Diablo 2 and the Diablo 2 expansion before we left Blizzard.
Interesting. And looking back at Diablo 2, that was probably like the first really big ARPG. I still remember, you know, trying to get the holiday to find that copy. Again, I get to mark how old I am, you know, when still going back to physical stores to get a game. Whereas, well, when Rebel Galaxy came out, it was just entering a code in onto Steam and changing things around. And that actually takes me to a really interesting question. I like to ask a lot of our developers who have been around the industry for 10 plus years. For you guys, what has been like your overall impressions of how much things have really changed back from, Eric, you said you started in the early 90s to where we are now? Because I can speak to enthusiasts and students all day long, but it's always interesting to hear from the people actually in the industry and how things have changed for them.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest changes is the internet alone. When we mm-hmm. started up in, what, 91 or something, we didn't really, maybe one of us could connect to the internet on a phone modem mm-hmm. for a little while, but we really had to kind of make up everything as we go along. You can't just look up, oh, how do people do occlusions and how do people mm-hmm. do these things? You'd have to buy a book. Maybe go to libraries. These days, you can just pretty much figure out how anyone did anything. So the internet was an early change that really changed game development completely. Then we've gone through so many different eras, you know, especially the PC is always dying. Everyone's always saying.
Yes, it's been dying for 20 years, maybe a little bit more at this point.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. The consoles are going to kill it. Mobile is going to kill it. We keep hearing these things. But I don't know. We've pretty much stuck to PC. Mm-hmm. We got some console co-release on this thing. But so that's something that didn't change. PC never really did die.
Yes.
I don't think it's about to either.
No, I wouldn't put bets on that right now. And again,
go ahead.
I was just going to talk a little bit about Steam, but get your thoughts out first, Travis.
One of the other things I think that's really different, apart from everything he mentioned about the internet, which is huge, is just that the scale of the industry is a lot bigger. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more games that come out now at a lot overall higher level of quality than used to come out. For a lot of the reasons. I mean, it's just a lot. It used to be a lot harder to make a game.
Yeah.
If you had to write the assembly for your polygon rendering, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of your
yes.
And the audience was smaller, so the budgets were smaller. It's a lot different now than it used to be. A lot different.
Yeah. And going back to what Eric just said about the internet, probably another big contributor to that would obviously be Steam. That's another thing that when it first came out, no one thought that was going to work. And here we are over 10 years later, and I have almost like 1,000 games on the platform. It's become almost an industry standard, especially for PC development and indie development as well, just to be able to get your game out there, not have to search for, you know, games on more than 24 different game sites and stores.
Just being able to publish without having a box where all the cost of, you got the cost of goods and you've mm-hmm. got all the, I mean, in olden days, when you actually put something in a box, the amount of money you got from the box was pretty small. Mm-hmm. But the take you get on Steam is just so much larger, and the lead time for getting it out to market is so short, as in like an hour.
Go ahead.
I mean, we basically worked on the game until the day of release, mm-hmm. and then we released it, which is, you know, would have been unheard of. What? How many years ago? Not that many years ago. 8?
Yeah. It definitely. And it's about getting the ease of the product out. I mean, as we said before the days of the internet or even before the days of broadband, if you want a copy of a game, you needed to mail it to someone, you need to print the physical copy of it out, get it to a store, etc. I mean, like with my experience, I mean, you guys literally sent me a key. 5 seconds later, it's on my Steam account and downloading. Never had to leave the computer. And It may sound like, for a lot of the younger people listening to this cast, it may sound like we're just talking, you know, the day-to-day, but it really has changed a lot, not just with game development, but just everything, that instant gratification. And that has also, what I think, Eric, what you were saying a few minutes ago regarding how easy it is for indie developers and how much the quality of games have risen up. We've also had issues or concerns regarding the industry sort of the bottom dropping out, because it's getting a lot harder to make a game that stands out when everyone's basically able to make a game of respectable quality.
I mean, I feel like in a lot of ways that's always existed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a smaller scale, but percentage-wise, it might not have been that different. I mean, there was a lot of garbage games that came out. Yeah. I mean, there's always been like a high level of stuff that didn't get noticed or get bought or and that was just not successful. And there was always, you know, kind of like a smaller band of really successful titles. I'm not sure that that's any different. I think there was like a short gold rush on Steam when it was fully Valve curated, which meant it was just throttled. There was only so many titles that showed up on it at once. And so there was a brief golden time, kind of like when the iPhone first came out, where you have this beachhead where people could do good business for just regardless, just by getting on the platform. And now that's gone again, just like it is on the iPhone.
Yeah. And
hey, pardon if my dog barks every now and then. He's,
that's all right.
He's kind of going crazy.
That's okay. Yeah, and about the time when Steam was created, I've spoken to a lot of developers who had trouble during that period because, as you were just saying, you really needed to know someone. You either need to know someone or you need a super high-quality game to be able to get on the Steam. Now, on the plus side, it meant that the games that were on Steam were usually high-quality. Like, there weren't too many shovelware titles. But at the same time, it was just so much harder to get your game on there if you didn't already have that established front. Now, fast forward to today, and with Greenlight and Early Access, it's just getting a lot easier to get those games on there. But that is one of those topics that we really are going to have to wait and see how things really develop. Because as we were just talking about like 5 minutes ago, people have been saying the PC industry was dying for 20-plus years. So who knows what's going to happen in the next 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's all changed pretty rapidly. When you've got Twitch streaming, I mean, in a lot of ways, that's what ended up being our advertising. We just gave out a bunch of Twitch keys. Way cheaper than a marketing budget, and people see the game being played as it is. There's not a lot of, you know, marketing magic dust. You know, we're not showing you something that it isn't. But it's a way to get awareness for a game where you might not traditionally have been able to get it. So it's just kind of like another tool that ends up fitting into the ecosystem for this.
Yeah, and same thing goes with Game Wisdom itself. When I started this about 3 years ago, it was just purely text pieces at all. And then I started with the podcast because it was a lot easier to explain things in words than it is just typing text. And then as of like 6-7 months ago, that's when I first started getting into streaming, recording video, that kind of thing. So now we have the Twitch channel, we have the podcast, and we also have the whole YouTube channel where all the videos I did with Rebel Galaxy are up. I now post smaller videos, and it's, as you said, Travis, it's just a lot easier and a lot cheaper in terms of advertising. You don't need to spend lots of money on a TV campaign or a website campaign where you can just give your keys out and then basically get free footage of your game from everyone who's enjoying it.
Yeah, a lot of marketing traditionally seems like it's been, we're going to put something that you don't want to see in front of you. And now we have all these amazing tools for avoiding that. You've got Netflix, so you never have to watch commercials, and you've got ad blocks, so you don't have to see anybody's ads on their website. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the last time I actually heard of a game via an ad.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, I mean, at this point, most ads are for, like, the big AAA games, which we either know about or, as you said, showing something that has, like, no relation to the actual game. Well, yeah, it's definitely interesting about how much things have changed. And, again, this is a topic we could spend an easy hour or 2 hours on. But let's move on. We've already spoke for about 20 minutes, so I don't want to keep you guys all night because I do have a lot of questions regarding ARPG design for both of you. So let's get to our first topic, and that is, of course, talking about Rebel Galaxy itself. As you guys were talking earlier in the cast, this is sort of a different beast compared to your previous titles. Obviously, we talked about, or partially talked about, Diablo, Hellgate, Torchlight, etc. So, my first question then for both of you is, where did the concept for Rebel Galaxy come from?
I guess there's a...
Go ahead.
I'll start, Travis. we've got a lot of influences, a lot of reasons that came up. Very specifically, we started making this game briefly at Runic Games with the whole team, with the whole 30 guys there. And it didn't quite take off, but so we canceled it, moved on to a different project. But in the back of our heads, both Travis and I think both still wanted to work on it. And when he proposed we start Double Damage, he said, hey, let's make that space game we were working on, which sounded great to me, too. So that was the specifics. But, I mean, my history, there's been a lot. I've been trying to make space games for a long time. I wanted to make one. We were deep into one at Blizzard when we left, actually. Mm-hmm. It was codenamed Starblow, like StarCraft / Diablo. It wasn't very similar. It had some relations to this, but I kind of always wanted to make a space game and never have. So this is my first game without swords in it, Travis often says.
Yep, and speaking about Rebel Galaxy, again, from the open space genre, as I said in my review, I'm not really an open space person myself, and playing Rebel Galaxy, I noticed there was a lot of interesting or different elements compared to the RPG genre. So, another question for you, Eric. What were, like, some unique design challenges or things you had to wrap your head around differently when approaching the open space genre versus the traditional ARPG genre?
Well, I think one thing we did have some models to work from here. We mm-hmm. both liked the privateer freelancer games, you know, from the early 90s. We cribbed a lot of the dynamics from those games. So we kind of knew in the beginning we wanted to do this trading open world game, and we kind of see the direction, a lot of the directions from those old games. A couple mm-hmm. other games that were big influences were Sid Meier's Pirates, sort of this idea mm-hmm. of you go from port to port and you do some trading, you do some politicking. Mm-hmm. Some Star Control 2, more of a strategy or action strategy game. So we had these game influences in mind when we decided on how to design this thing. So we kind of combined those influences with our ARPG experience, and I don't know, felt like it flowed pretty naturally from the beginning. It doesn't feel like we struggled with mm-hmm. concepts very much.
There's a lot of, I mean, conceptual differences to like the way that you move and yeah. combat versus traditional space traders, which I think makes it a little more accessible and also makes it different.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do a cockpit sim because mm-hmm. there's plenty of those, and there's really high profile ones coming out like right around now. There was Elite, mm-hmm. you know, which is still in development. And they're still adding stuff. There's Star Citizen, which does like everything. And then there's No Man's Sky, and all of those have that kind of classic cockpit mm-hmm. sim thing.
Yeah.
When Eric first brought up the idea of doing a space game, I wanted to do it naval style because I had played Assassin's Creed Black Flag, and I thought that was really it was a cool combat system, and mm-hmm. I thought it could be extra cool if you know put it in space and you added laser beams and shields and all this other space stuff, fighters. Mm-hmm. It became more of like a World War II style naval combat when you know throw in fighter craft, which obviously did not exist in pirate times. And so we sort of ran with that, and it had one of the limitations that it brought with it was putting everything more or less on a plane, although it's not really flat. It's like a big space waves, but effectively you only navigate in two dimensions, mm-hmm. which a lot of people are like, oh my God, why are you doing this? Aren't you insane? But in a lot of ways, having a limiting factor is what makes things more playable.
Yeah.
So it's easy to fly around and explore and find stuff and run into things, which is not traditionally the case with space trading sims. There's a lot of empty space and, you know, going through nothing until you get to like a little node of fighters or whatever at some nav point floating in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, I love that, but it's kind of an acquired taste.
Yeah. And a great point, Travis. You not only brought my next point in question, you actually answered at the same time regarding the shift to more the naval style, as you said, more like the, not so much 2D, but more like the wave plane design. Because that is a really good point regarding the accessibility. As you're saying, there are a lot of cockpit-focused space games out on the market, and it is a genre for a lot of new players that can be very daunting to get into. I tried getting into one last year, and I just, load up. I had no idea what I was doing with this cockpit, and I just, flew into, a plane and killed myself, 5 minutes, and I was like, okay, I'm done with this. But shifting it to being more of, a pirate ship, or more of a third-person style combat and control system, is a lot easier to wrap your head around.
Yeah, there's better situational awareness, yeah. And, it's just not concerned with whether you know which switches to flip to turn things on.
Mm-hmm.
It also has different kind of tactics than the dogfight sort of tactics, which I find kind of tiring myself. I mean, physically tiring. I play those games for a half hour, mm-hmm. and I'm exhausted. I can't just sit there and play all day long I have to when I develop a game like this.
Space jousting. I mean, you have these long turning battles, and then a brief period where something is attackable, and you attack it, and then it gets out of range or out of view, and then you're in the long, turning battle where you're trying to get behind him, or you're all flying way far away from each other, and then you turn around, you come back, and you shoot briefly, and you space joust, and then you fly past each other, and then you do it all over again.
Yeah, and with Rebel Galaxy, it avoids all that by being more about these ships. Now, what's interesting is that in the game, you control, I believe, Corvette class and up ships, and then the smaller ships, the fighters and the gunships, they operate like a traditional space game. They operate full 360 degree. When you guys were designing the game, did you at all think about letting the player control those fighters, or was it just straight from the beginning you want to be Corvette and up?
Well, we thought early on about letting you temporarily control some, but mostly it was just a matter of limited time and doing one thing and doing it right, as opposed to trying to do more than one thing. Because you effectively have to do more than one control scheme, which means you have to spend a lot of time trying to make sure that it's easy for people to map from one to the other.
Yeah,
it's like a lot of first-person shooters where you hop in a vehicle,
yeah,
and they're like competitive multiplayer shooters, and there's usually some shift to the controls when you move over that's initially just like, oh my god, what do I do? What goes forward? Oh, crap. And then you invariably crash into something the first 10 times you get in a vehicle. Getting over those humps and making that stuff work is a lot of work, and we just didn't think it was something that we should try and do both of them in a first game.
Yeah,
there's a fair amount of risk when you're just kind of inventing a game out from scratch like this. That there's a big risk that we could have. What if we made one of the fighting modules? What if we made the dogfighty fighter stuff good, and then the naval broadsides was bad? You have to make both types really good, or else the game is terrible.
Yeah.
And so it was just beyond the scope of what we were trying to do, just in kind of inventing almost a little genre here.
Yeah. Actually, shipping something is basically saying no a lot.
Oh yeah, definitely. I just spoke with one of the guys from Harebrained Schemes, who just wrapped up the BattleTech Kickstarter, and he talked about a lot of what he has to do is say no to ideas that he knows would be completely out of scope, completely out of budget.
And they could be amazing ideas. Yeah. They could make an incredible game, but sometimes you just can't make them.
Exactly. Or you can make them. It's just going to take who knows how much more money and how much time that you may not have to begin with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, another part of Rebel Galaxy in terms of the control and the play of it is actually customizing and outfitting your ship. Now, this sort of reminds me of a traditional RPG. You have the different module slots, you have the components, shields, etc. As you guys were coming up with this kind of progression system, how did you decide how far to, base it in terms of ARPG design, and how far to base in terms of the open space genre design?
Yeah, I think it was it was kind of iterative. We just kind of started with a ship, and just kind of thought, hey, what do we want to do on the ship? Well, we want to change out the turrets and the different kind of guns. And just kind of took it from there. I mean, I'm sure that lots of our experience from both playing these kind of games and from our ARPG stuff fed into it. But when we started, we didn't have a grand design of all the different things we'd change or not. We had a big list of the things we could do, but just kind of took it as we played. Hey, well, we got to get some better engines in here. We got to get some defense type of things going on. a way to have another weapon. You know, we came up with these secondary weapons. Usually they're like the flak guns or guided missiles. But it was mostly just from playing and deciding where what we wanted to do as players, I'd say.
And we did want to do, I mean, there may be some iteration on it. I know that Eric initially was thinking about it more in terms of ARPG, like, mm-hmm. equipment. My initial thrust was I wanted to do something that was economic and get away from, I wanted to do like a really classic space sim economic advancement where you get money and money is your advancement and it's all about getting cash, however you get cash. And then we have, you know, multiple ways to get cash or steal it, mm-hmm. So that your advancement could be tied into being a pirate or whatever. And I think we talked a lot early on about like doing things like socketing and having like rare versions of equipment that would have special properties. But I feel like we dropped that mm-hmm. relatively early on, those concepts, and stuck to the more straightforward economic advancement.
Yeah, one of the things I heard from a few of my more ARPG focused friends, they also noticed the fact that you don't gain traditional experience from fighting enemies. As you said, Travis, money is pretty much your main progression. It could be considered your experience because that's what you're going to use to buy a new ship, buy better modules, etc. And again, that's one of the things that's interesting about trying to bridge these two different genres together.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I don't think of it as an action RPG at all mm-hmm. because it doesn't, in a lot of ways, it doesn't play like them. I mean, it yeah. doesn't, there's no skills. You don't really have I mean, your ship is your character as far as that goes. And mm-hmm. and again, it's all economic advancement. And the combat is much less abstracted into numbers and much more physical and about actually moving and dodging and tactics. So it really doesn't, I mean, it doesn't play like Diablo in space or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was never really intended to either. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like a palate cleanser. We've been making a lot of action RPGs. And I think both of us are just kind of fed up with doing the same thing for a little bit. I mean, I don't want to speak for Eric, but I was done. I didn't want to make another friggin' action RPG in a row. So I really wanted to do something that felt totally different and that involved coming up with stuff that was different and wasn't like, well, Diablo has synergies. Why don't you have synergies? And I don't like passive skills because I've played them in all these other games. It's just we got to ditch all this baggage, mm-hmm. and then just make a game that hopefully is, you know, evaluated more on its own terms. And it has its problems and it has its things. I think it is really successful at it, but mm-hmm. they're not about, you know, how closely it hews to the Diablo formula.
Yeah, definitely. Eric, do you have any thoughts on what he was just saying?
Yeah, I think when I initially was kind of kicking around ideas, it was along the lines of, oh, you kill this ship and maybe he's going to drop a +5 laser turret of fire, you know, and make all these kind of RPG things. And when Travis proposed the economic progression, I really liked the idea. I just kind of like, yeah, you know what? It's going to be a good break. It's a new challenge. It's keeps it simpler. So I latched onto it pretty quick too, and enjoyed making it that way. I think it still does have some action RPG things. I mean, you're still doing, you do missions to try to upgrade so you can do mm-hmm. the stronger missions and get your way through. There's still some cool action RPG stuff in there, but yeah, this was about two things. It was about a new challenge and a palate cleanser, something for mm-hmm. us to do. And it was what is reasonable for two guys to do.
Yeah.
It's really hard to, we couldn't make a Torchlight or Diablo clone. That took 30 guys in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it's probably just impossible. Maybe we could do new things and try new stuff out. But like Travis was saying, people would just always compare it. Well, it's not as good as Torchlight in this way. It's not as good mm-hmm. as Diablo in this. So this was kind of a decision to keep it simple and just do new stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things I also liked about doing the economic stuff versus like drops mm-hmm. was that it meant that you could advance in the game without purely grinding out kills.
Yes.
Like the only path to getting this equipment is not just going and shooting dudes over and over until things drop.
Mm-hmm.
But then any activity, since all of them effectively result in money, becomes a viable activity to advance, and it doesn't shoehorn you into only doing the one thing.
Yeah.
If you want to go and just, if you want to just trade to advance, then that becomes viable to get better equipment through trading. If you want to talk your way out of stuff and bluff people into giving you money, then you didn't circumvent your path to getting the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that because I think it just forces it to forces you to allow people to play it in other ways.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that. That's definitely a cool, good point to talk about when we get more into ARPG design in a few minutes. But I definitely want to touch on that now. That's one of the things I've seen in a lot of ARPGs, struggling to find that balance of probably giving you a motivation or probably progressing the player through strictly through loot-based design. Because what ends up happening is either A, the player gets so much loot that it just bogs the game down, and it's like, do I take the flaming spike of ice or the ice staff of fire, you know, 0.1.7 DPS change, or you run into the problem where it's so limited that it becomes a needle in the haystack, and you're just trying to get that one piece of gear you need to go from being killed all the time to making the game completely easy. And then that in itself has its own problems.
Yeah, sure does. That's stuff we I think wisely avoided here.
Yes. Yeah. Now, another thing I want to touch on is you guys were talking about in terms of Rebel Galaxy being a palate cleanser compared to a traditional ARPG. Is the actually open-endedness of the game. Unlike a traditional ARPG where you're limited to either linear dungeon maps or randomly generated spaces, you guys went for these massive galaxies to explore and populate. Was it a big shift in terms of changing the design from focusing on these, you know, compact dungeons to basically saying, here's an entire sector, go nuts?
I mean, there's definitely differences to how you design it. It's still randomly generated, and so there's still a certain amount of just the way that we think about populating areas that goes into that. We definitely did a lot of work to have like safe zones that you would start in and to try and give you tools to recognize when you were going to get screwed so that you could leave. Lots of subtle little things. If you're early in the game and you don't have very much equipment and you come back up against stuff that's really a lot more difficult than you, they'll detect that and automatically like nerf their pursuit ranges and their firing ranges just to give you a chance to actually get away. Because it's not really that fun to stumble across something that's just going to annihilate you and then they annihilate you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely different.
It was fun to play with the scope, though. Like, we had a bunch of different solar system sizes and kept, you know, actually we ended up shrinking them down very unrealistic scale just through play. But that, it was just a cool thing to work with and say, hey, how big do we want this place to be? How can we keep it full of life? And so you're always running into things while you're flying around. Those are really hard things to plan out without actually just getting the game working and seeing how it feels while you're in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Now, we are definitely moving along with the cast. I know we don't want to go all night long, so I just have a few more general questions regarding Rebel Galaxy, and then we'll move on to our final topic. So, I guess one question I like to ask a lot of developers, especially post-mortem after a game is released, were there any interesting or unique concepts that you guys were developing that didn't ultimately make it into the game or were just left on the cutting room floor?
Oh, yeah, always.
Yeah. General ideas, there's a billion. We have nothing but ideas all the time.
Yeah.
I think one of the ones I like to throw out there is that I wanted space monsters in the game. Like, I don't know, giant octopus in space.
You really wanted space jellyfish and, like, you know, bigger, and which I don't object to at all. Mostly it was more just a technical hurdle for me to deal with collision on big animated objects that was just too much for me to spend time doing on this specific game. Mm-hmm. But it would have been super cool.
Yeah.
I wanted gambling in the game so that if you went to a station, you could gamble some kind of game. I don't know, either a weird like digital, Vegas style slot thing that was all spaced up or actual poker or a dice game or something where you could gamble. We also talked to one thing we really wanted was like a station affiliation so that you could kind of like choose a station and they would have things for you to do, missions that were specific to the station that would unlock things on the station, like, oh, now the station can produce this, or now this rank of stuff becomes available because you helped out this station, to give like a little more personality and like advancement that you can do there. We always talked about like the space crab pots where you could go and like set up like some sort of harvester or something somewhere and then you'd get notified when it was full and you could go get whatever it got out of it. Maybe it was a gas harvester, or maybe it was, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But then they could also be attacked, and then you could go and defend them. And I mean, we could go on for a long time with stuff that we thought would really be really cool in a space game. But
yeah,
yeah, it's kind of like all directions. We could have, yeah. We could have done more with the factions. We could have done more with mining. But you know, again, we're keeping it kind of tight, yeah. And we're inventing the game as we go. So I think, you know, we're in good position for any kind of sequel or anything, because yeah. Now we kind of have a basis and can add just cool new things. But it's hard to add these cool new things while you're inventing.
Of course, the game. Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I think that's why most people's favorite game is almost always the sequel. Mm-hmm. It's TIE Fighter. It's Free Space 2. It's mm-hmm. Star Control 2. It's almost always the sequel. Nobody's like, oh God, Uncharted was great. It's always Uncharted 2 was freaking amazing. Yeah. Because the first one is where you like, you cut your way through the grass and you figure out what the game actually is. Mm-hmm. And then there's all these paths that dead ended, or that you know, maybe we would have done this different if we'd known how this was going to pan out in the end. Mm-hmm. And then the sequel is always the one where we already know the terrain, and it's just about making it as amazing as possible.
Yeah. And that's a really good point, Travis. It's something that I've said about a lot of the games I review for the site. As you said, there's a lot of great concepts with these first games. And then traditionally, it's the sequel that people will, as you said, it's you've already explored. Now it's time to actually make something of it. Another great example would be like Assassin's Creed 2. The jump from the first to the second one was one of like the biggest, I think, in terms of like a major franchise.
Yeah.
A lot of people didn't really talk about the first one, and the second one was like, oh my God, you have to play this game. And again, it's because that foundation was set from the first game, and they were able to use that to build off of, instead of, as you were just saying, you know, designing it and building it as you go. Which
Diablo
typically...
2, Warcraft 2, yeah. I mean, those are all the those are always the ones that people go back to, is the second yeah. one. Warcraft 2, Diablo 2.
Yeah, it's very rare to see the first game like be like the big winner. Like, you get it right your first time. I mean, we could arguably say World of Warcraft, but then again, that game's had I don't even know how many expansions and
well, and it's basically passes. EverQuest
yeah.
2, right?
Yeah,
Warcraft is basically let's take EverQuest and then let's just make it amazing. It had the ground had been traversed once,
yeah,
or many times, honestly, as far yep. as MMOs go.
And that, going back to what we were talking about earlier with the game industry, that's why we see a lot of developers either copy or inspire by other games, because they already see how it worked here, and then they can say, oh, they did it this way, but what if we go this way with it? We can build something differently that way.
Well, and that was a huge benefit to us in making this game. I mean, there's certain yeah. concepts in here that are time-worn. I mean, yeah. there have been lots of space trading games made, so that was something that we could look at and say, okay, we want to take that general kind of progression, and we know that works. Mm-hmm. And then we picked what we wanted to do that was different, which for us in this case was the combat system, because
yeah.
it's never been done this way before. I mean, it certainly got inspiration from Assassin's Creed's naval combat, but there's just not a lot of lasers there. It just doesn't really play like that game. The yeah. fundamental idea of like, oh yes, it's naval and you can fire from broadsides and you can do some sort of like charging with broadsides is really the root of it. But everything else it plays pretty darn different. Yeah. And that was where a lot of our iteration and development time went. And then tying that together in an open world was the other part of it. And those were things that we had never really done before. And that frankly were a lot of fun.
Yeah. And that actually takes me to a brief, not so much a tangent, but just a quick curiosity question about Rebel Galaxy. And that has to do with the procedurally generated missions, or the randomly generated missions. We normally don't see all that in traditionally RPG design. How did you guys approach building like the system to generate these different quests for the player?
I mean, a lot of it came off of the story quests. So the story quests were always like the first version of something for the most part. Mm-hmm. With the exception of the very first, like, just go kill five ships sort of missions.
Mm-hmm.
So the scripting that we could do for those got built out and became more complicated, the more complicated the story missions became. And then we would kind of, like, tear that off and consolidate it into a kind of mission.
Okay.
Like going and retrieving a dead drop or whatever. There'd be a story mission that did it first. I'd implement all the scripts that would be exposed to allow that to happen, and then we would make side missions. And Eric made, I don't know, a ton of side missions. He probably never wants to make a side mission again. but we had a basic scripting system that allowed them to be made, which actually worked out pretty well. But there were new, we were having kind of some new mission types coming in up until close to the end, because, you know, some new story mission would go in, which would let you do something that you hadn't been able to do before.
Okay.
Yeah, an example would be like we'd have ambushes of ships coming in after you're already in the fight. For a long time through development, we didn't really have those. And then suddenly Travis made that happen for one of the storyline missions. And then I said, oh, okay, that's a great way to make other missions harder. So I went and took a bunch of our random missions and kind of retrofitted them to have these ambushes.
And then we do things like you could flip the alliance of a ship in flight. And then now that becomes available to use in a side mission, or, you know, ships could be disabled and then get enabled after a time period. So you'd have like a disabled ship and you have to do something before the ships come online, and all of that sort of stuff would just trickled in over the course of development.
Cool. Now, I guess this is probably one of my last questions regarding Rebel Galaxy itself, but as we were just talking about in terms of building the foundation and setting the game up for sequel, whatever, have you guys thought about making a sequel or DLC content or anything like that for Rebel Galaxy?
We've thought about it, of course, but we are it's too raw now to bite the bullet. don't want to do that much work quite yet again.
I have trouble imagining that we would do an expansion or DLC. I mean, I think that if we did it, we would do it as a sequel.
Okay.
Because you get a lot more latitude. I don't have to worry about whose save game I would preserve, you know, if you do a sequel, which means you can really break things and do them very differently.
And again, you have the foundation already set from the first Rebel Galaxy that you can build on, as opposed to building and then designing new stuff at the same time.
It's like a conceptual foundation at this point. We know how these things worked and where a lot of the holes are that we stepped in the first time.
Also, it being a two-man team, it's not like we have junior guys to hand off the DLC to, or
we don't
sitting around doing nothing. We can get them to make some content, you know. So there's no efficiency there to help us.
Yeah. All right. Before we move on to our final section, are there any other parts of the development of Rebel Galaxy that you guys want to talk about that I didn't cover or I forgot?
I think that it's important for me in any of these kind of games to be able to play it nonstop. I mean, I have to play like 8 hours a day for months, and that sort of drives how the games get made. It makes it much better for randomization. If the game's not randomized, it gets really boring to play as often as I have to. So I think that a lot of the way the game ends up feeling is because we sort of design it so that we can just play it ourselves all the time. It helps and hurts in the design, but that's a lot of the reasons stuff came out like it did.
We get a closed loop pretty quick, you know. We get the prototype up and running as soon as possible, and then it just stays running forever.
Yeah. One of the things I love working with Travis with is he's the only engineer, really. He just keeps the game bug-free at all times. So it's never like, oh, I got to wait a week to see how this stuff's going to work, or I can't test this stuff out until he fixes X. So things move around, move along very quickly and cleanly, because we don't let any kind of bugs rest, and we don't say, hey, we'll get to that in a week or two. Everything just kind of is very immediate, a little bit different than most development environments.
Yeah. And I remember during like the week or two before the launch, I remember I showed one of my videos to Travis, and he goes, oh, I saw a bug with one of the quest chains. I'll fix that right now for you.
Yeah.
I go, that's service right there. That's good service.
Can't let that stuff sit. Can't let that stuff sit. It rots.
Yeah.
we don't have a QA team, so that was the other good reason to give it over to the hands of YouTubers and Skype and Twitchers. We would just watch their streams to find the bugs.
That's one of the big drawbacks of random games. You know, it's a lot easier to get full coverage on a game that's completely linear. Randomized games, if you've got how many hundred side mission variants that all are then have sub-randomization, how do you even cover that? You just do your best and you try and make sure the systems are solid, but there's always something that creeps through.
Yeah, but that's a quick aside. That's another good thing we saw about early access and what that's doing for game developers. with getting your game in front of who knows how many eyes, picking apart your game from every angle, and finding those bugs within that one small quest chain that no one really thought about that you would never have found unless someone played the hell of your game during development.
Yep, we chose not to do the early access, but the way giving out the keys, as many keys as we did that early, was very similar.
Definitely. Yeah, this has been a great conversation with both of you so far. I mean, I would love to pick your guys' brains about like the whole Hellgate and that kind of situation, but we are somewhat pressed for time. I don't want to keep you guys too late. It is about just after 9 my time. I think it's like a little after
6.
I think what, like 6 your time. So yeah, I mean, one of the great things about these casts is we can go almost all night. But that's one of the bad things, too. So we don't want to turn this into a little, like, 2-3 hour powwow.
My dogs are already staring at me waiting for dinner, but happy to see you.
Yeah, I don't want gotta keep the dogs at bay.
Exactly.
So for our final topic then tonight, I know you guys are probably still a little sick and tired of the ARPG genre, but I do want to ask you guys just a few questions regarding the general development or philosophy behind the games, because as I said earlier in the cast, you two are my first guests on who have actually been a part of several big name ARPGs, and it's a genre that I've grown to like, and it's also one of those ones that it's very interesting to pick out the ones that work versus the ones that don't, because it is such a interesting genre of abstracted gameplay and then the twitch skills of the player themselves. So I guess my first question, I'm not sure this is either going to be a very short answer or a very long one, would be, in both of your opinions, what elements do you think make a good ARPG, or what makes one that works that someone wants to keep playing?
Well, I think I'll throw one of them out, and that's a crispy sort of gameplay. It's got to be really, the mouse keyboard action has to be really responsive. When you click, there's a lot of timing involved in how long the swing takes, where the contact points are in the animations, where the sounds get played. These things are not as easy as it might seem. They take a lot of work. And I think a lot of games, they feel a little sluggish, or they just don't feel crisp. So I think I always kind of point to crispness and crunchiness. When you hit a monster in these little ARPGs, a skeleton's a perfect idea. You really want it to kind of shatter, you know. It's got a really responsive, like boom, and you feel these things happening. And I think that's the hallmark of good ones versus bad ones these days. But also, what it took us a long time to develop back in the Diablo days. It took a lot of iteration to kind of get it to feel right.
I agree with that. There's a lot of non-intuitive parts to that too. Things that look cool that don't necessarily work, because some of it's just like, it's almost like a musical tempo. There's like a pace to things that needs to be regular and predictable. You're like, if I click and this, if I hit 3 times in a row, it's going to follow this pacing, and it's going to be very satisfying because it happens when I expect it to happen. And it's really easy when you have an animator working on something for kind of the animators to get carried away, and now there's a long follow through on this animation, and this animation is a little bit longer than that animation, and all those things break the pace. And it doesn't feel right, and it's like walking up stairs in the dark, and they're all different heights. It's fundamentally unsatisfying.
That tactile feedback I think is a big draw of the RPG genre. A good example again, like, would be like the Diablo series, like Diablo 3, for instance. When you're playing like as a witch doctor, it's a complete different feel to it when you're playing as a crusader or a barbarian or etc. And then, as you were saying, with like the animations, when you hit an enemy with like an explosive, he doesn't just like fall to the ground dead. He, you know, blows up into these chunks and then fly off in different directions and then bounce off the environment. And it just creates this very satisfying feel to it. Because again, you're expecting it to happen. You know, if I hit him with X, Y is going to be the result. And then you get it. And it goes back to, I think, what you were saying a few minutes ago regarding like that closed loop. When you get it just right, I know one of like the classic things with the RPG is sort of like fight, loot, repeat. That's pretty much like the coda for the genre.
So I think one of the things that's interesting about that is you want your combat to be really predictable and satisfying and have this sort of metronomic pace to it. But then on progression, a lot of people seem to want to do very, very, very smooth progression, yeah. where it's just like if you drew a line from the equipment from here to here over these levels, it would be this nice line. Your progression would be smooth. Mm-hmm. And I think Eric and I both agree that that's not necessarily good, that there should be spikes mm-hmm. and dips and these sudden seemingly imbalanced spurts of power that you get that make you feel amazing. Mm-hmm. And waiting for one of those to happen is really rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that goes back to like the whole rarity system that we've seen populate so many ARPGs. You get, like, in Diablo, for instance, once you get your first rare item, then you don't really need magic or common gear items anymore. And then you find your first legendary, your first set item, and that becomes, you know, as you were just saying, that becomes that power booster for the next 3 to 5 levels, or even more so.
There's a lot of weird little satisfying things about ARPGs. There's, like, zone clearing where you do like the lawnmower and you're like, oh, it feels so good. And now all the fog of war is gone. It feels so clean. There's weird satisfaction in that. There's just satisfaction in putting stuff on your character and having those cool like chunk slap sounds when you're putting stuff on. It's just these weird little moment to moment things. And then there's, you got your longer term, oh, but it's all in service to this large plan I have for this character where they're going to be really amazing at this way off down the line. It's got lots of, you know, bigger, larger and larger loops of satisfaction.
And the thing with the RPG genre, though, is that if the details don't work, that's one of the things we see a lot of the RPGs slip up on. Like, as we said, if the combat doesn't feel right, if the items don't work, all that stuff just bleeds into the rest of the game experience, and it's basically like the spoiled well taints the source, or the war, I forget that expression, but it just flows out and affects everything.
Yeah, pretty much all the loops have to work.
Yeah. And that takes me to another good question I ask you guys then. As we were just saying, in terms of what makes a good ARPG, are there any like red flags you've either played in ARPGs that you haven't played, or I'm sorry, you haven't designed, or ones that you were building that you had to change, that sort of lead into that when ARPG doesn't work that well?
Well, there's a few. I think drawn from my own experience on the Hellgate London, a million things went wrong with that game. But I think one of them was that it just wasn't a place you wanted to live in. I think you really want to feel comfortable and kind of, I don't know. It's got to be aesthetically pleasing to hang out in these ARPG worlds. And that's why I think that a lot of the knockoffs don't quite work very well. They're just like not well thought out. They don't seem like real places. And I think that I sort of felt that I was never happy with that in the Hellgate London. So I noticed that in other games, other ARPGs that I play from other people, that I just don't want to live here. I just don't want this to be my guy. So I think the successful ones hit that and the unsuccessful ones don't really.
All right. Travis, you have anything to add?
Whiffy combat. I don't like whiffy combat. Any whiffy combat.
Should never miss.
Missing is never really fails that great. And, you know, anything that makes you feel muddy. It's just a muddiness to things that I don't like that at all. Sometimes just meaningless choice. Mm. A lot of people, you end up with is just a bunch of crap, and I don't really care about any of it because all of the differences are minor. It just becomes work. It's like going into a grocery store and there's 500 raspberry jellies. I just want some freaking raspberry jelly. I don't want to read the labels. I don't want to see how much sugar is in this one. Can we just have three kinds of jelly? So I think you can also spoil people for meaningless choice. And that's, I get turned off by that pretty quickly.
Yeah. I am really glad you brought that up, Travis, because that's definitely become one of my pet peeves with the RPG genre. And one of the things I'm sort of glad Diablo 3 moved away from in the sense of making it less muddy. Like, as I was saying when we were talking earlier with loot design, there are games where, you know, you kill an enemy and like 10 different hats will drop with like 0.0035 variable difference between the different stats. And it's like, what the hell? Am I going to have to look through each one of these things? Just tell me what is the best one. And pretty much what I do in these situations, I just go by gold value, how much it costs to resell it. Okay, this one is 500 to sell. Okay, I'll keep that one. I don't care about if it, you know, it's 0.02% better or worse than this one. I don't want to deal with that. And that's one of the things I like about with Diablo 3. I know a lot of people didn't like when they switched to just saying all gear will give you a rating in terms of, I think, damage, defense, and health. That's it. That's all you need to look at to determine how great or bad a piece of gear is. And I just really like that because, again, I don't need to spend 20 minutes looking through 20 different swords. Okay, this one has the highest plus damage. This one has the highest plus defense. Good, go, you know, let's go back to the killing.
One of the things I like that Eric did on Torchlight 2 is he spent a lot of time on the effects and how they got distributed between things to mm-hmm. ideally make it more of like an interesting decision about, oh, well, do I want this kind of effect? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a weapon that's going to be really great if I summon stuff, or this is a weapon that's going to be really great if I do X, Y, or Z. That's a more interesting thing to hem and haw and chew your nails over than, well, if it's 1 point better in this and then it's 1 point lower in this.
Exactly. As you say, instead of it's about a numerical choice, it's more about your strategy or your build choice. So, yes, this sword will give me 10 plus damage, but it's going to lower my pet minion damage, which if I'm building a pet class, that would be more important to me than just pure damage. And it just makes things a lot more interesting when you're thinking about on those terms instead of those minute differences.
Yep.
And another good point that you mentioned, Travis, in terms of like fiddling combat or muddy combat, or just giving player too many choices, I see a lot of ARPGs go for massive like skill trees. You get like 20 different slots to try to like put your skills in, and it just slows things down for me because a lot of it is just these very benign choices. Again, it goes back to, do you want plus 2 fire damage here? You put, you know, 10 skill points in here. Do you want to give your guys a 10% chance to possibly revive? And again, it all just muddies the water and just makes it a lot harder to get back, again, to that closed loop or that main gameplay loop that you've spent so much time building.
That's another thing that I think Blizzard does really well. They did in their previous games, and then when they took over on that, made Diablo 3, is they make the characters obvious. You see the character and you say, okay, that's what this character is going to do. And that's why you find loot in Diablo 3, and you know, okay, that's going to be perfect for my Crusader, because it looks mm-hmm. like a Crusader shield or something.
Yeah.
And that poorly designed ARPGs, it's kind of like, well, I don't know. Is this guy supposed to have fire damage? Why is he holding a bow? Should that even be doable? So they kind of do a great job of making you feel like you can tell what the character is supposed to do.
Yeah. And then it goes back to also like with the lore building as well. Like they create these elaborate backstories for all their classes. I love that back in the Diablo 1, Diablo 2 days, when like the manual had like 30 pages of like lore about the world and the characters and all the skills. I'm just a sucker for games that go that far into like the actual world building, where it's not just, you know, go out and kill a monster. You get like the whole backstory, like the monster's genealogy, the history of your weapons, stuff like that.
Yep. I think, like, for instance, on Rebel Galaxy here, we've got a bunch of backstory that we haven't really told the story very much of these guys. Who are these races, like the Korians and the Greel? But I think that's sort of like, again, like our Diablo 1. We talked about Diablo, but not really where he came from. Mm. We met, you know, there's the Skeleton King, there's the Butcher, and these guys. They ended up getting fleshed out kind of after the game, and then into Diablo 2, and then into Diablo 3, and then they become rich whole worlds of things. It's kind of an exciting area that if we continue with the Rebel Galaxy, I'm sure we'll do a much better job of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still have my manual somewhere around here of Diablo 1, Diablo 2, so maybe I'll look them up and just go back through all those details.
Yep.
Yeah, I miss the days of manuals.
Oh, yeah.
A PDF manual is just not the same thing.
No, nobody.
Thank you.
Nobody opens those.
Yeah. If you guys were in the room right now, I'd have to just, like, give you a high five for saying that. I love the old school manuals. again, give me like all that lore, give me all that backstory. I want to learn about the game, you know, not when I'm sitting in front of the computer, but, you know, when I'm like sitting in a chair relaxing, I'll pull out like a manual and just read it that way. And it just seems a lot easier for me to process things rather than scrolling down, you know, a massive 100-page PDF on my computer.
Yep.
Now, going back to poor or troublesome issues with ARPG design, one thing, again, going with like the non-choice thing, I think another issue that I saw was with the game Path of Exile. Did you guys play that one?
Yeah. I have not really played it very much, but I'm familiar.
I really like those guys. Grinding gear.
Yeah. I mean, the game is impressive, especially, again, coming from a small, relatively unknown studio. But one of the things that I hear a lot that's polarizing was the, you know, sprawling, all-encompassing, you know, skill tree of madness. You know, like, all those different passive skills that you can unlock. And it goes, again, back to what we were saying with a good RPG. You know, everything looks like it should fit. Like, you know how your crusader is going to be. You know how this is going to work. And you see and you get that immediate feedback. But with, like, that kind of skill tree, it's one of the things that you can spend hours trying to build it up. And it's just very hard to properly plan your character out compared to, say, Diablo 3 or even Diablo 2's 3 skill tree progression.
And some of that, I think, gets down to what audience you're appealing to, right? Yeah. I mean, for the same reason that we're... If you want to play a space sim where you get to flip all the switches and you control how the fuel lines work, I mean, that's a specific audience that wants that level of control, and they really like it. And I think that the same thing probably exists for ARPGs, where there's kind of distinct audiences. There are people who are really into the numbers and the fundamentals of how this stuff all fits together, and that's not busy work to them. And then there are people who just want to sit down and chill out and watch dudes explode and the skeleton bones bounce off the wall. And I think you can probably make games that appeal to both camps, but then I think you can also make games that are on kind of the more extreme ends of the spectrum.
Definitely. Now, getting close to wrapping up, but there's one question that I would be kicking myself if I didn't bring up during the cast. And that is one of the other very tricky parts of ARPG design, and that is creating an effective end game or even late game experience, because a lot of ARPGs are designed around quote-unquote endless replayability. We saw, like, with Diablo 2, all the different difficulty levels. Diablo 3 has, you know, Torment. We're up to Torment 10 right now. And one of the other big challenges I see is defining a proper endgame where the player is, you know, all-powerful. We talk about putting on, like, the badass gear, having all your skills, but still giving them a reason to keep playing. So I wanted to get both you guys' thoughts on that topic, on specifically, like, creating that endgame experience.
Yeah, I think we invented what the new game plus idea with the Diablo, and that's it would just replay the same game, but with your guy fully advanced. Everything else just got ratcheted up in difficulty. Diablo 3 has taken it to new extremes with they have all kind of new loot, you know, throughout for all the new difficulty levels. And maps to play is something we did in Torchlight, and I think they've done now. And Path of Exile does the same. But I think it was a matter of when we were doing the Diablo, it was like, well, we're close to the end of Diablo 2. That was probably 6 months from shipping. Mm-hmm. We kind of decided, well, it would be nice to just keep playing. How are we going to make it possible? And just kind of invented the idea, well, let's just replay from scratch. And then figure out how that's going to work out, you know, and figure out how we're going to have to adjust all the monsters, basically, and the loot and things to make that count in the experience tables. And it was pretty much all, in Diablo 2, it was all pretty theoretical. We literally had maybe a week or two of testing on all the difficulty modes. That got patched up, and then there's the 1.10 patch kind of made it really clean on that, I think. But it was kind of amazingly just slapped in at the last second and not tested, and then became part of the story of the game. So after that, people have done a much better job. I think we did a much better job in the Torchlight stuff. Certainly Diablo 3 has. But the other thing I want to throw in here is, for me, a big replayability long-term thing are the hardcore modes, where you're just going to lose your guy at some point. that was kind of my brainstorm. At least I backed it up in the early days. But that's what I do all the time. When I go back and play Torchlight now, I just play a hardcore guy, see how far I can get him. And for me, that helps the replayability almost more than the difficulty modes.
Mm. Okay. And Travis, you have any thoughts?
So I'm like the worst person to ask about this because I never replay games when I get to the end of them. At least not with, I never do it like where it's going to be like a continuation. I don't know why. It's like I advanced and now I'm done. If I play it again, I want to play it a different way.
Okay.
So I want to do a different character class or a different something else. Yeah. That's more like my personal preference than anything else. I don't know if I have a ton to add. I'm probably the worst person to ask. I'm almost always in our partnership. I'm almost always more focused on like the short to midterm advancement feel. And I think Eric really takes care of the long-term advancement and makes sure that we don't go off the map there.
Yep. And I've been getting more like that with playing Diablo 3. Again, I've been playing the game. Wow. I don't even know how many hours I'm up to. But you can only really do the same thing for so long before it gets repetitive. So now, whenever there's a new season, I basically play a hardcore character. I pick a different class per season. And that's sort of like my to-do project for like 2-3 weeks. Get it up to the top, maybe play a little bit more. Then I retire. Next season, new character, etc. And that sort of is the way that I'm trying to keep the game going for as long as possible. Because I think I'm similar to you, Travis. I can't play a game forever. I don't have one game that I could just play every day of my life from now until the end. I would just go mad playing one game, so I have to switch between like 5 or 10 different games. This has been a great cast so far, guys. The RPG genre is such a rich genre to talk about that there's no way we could give it full credit in just like a 30-minute section here. So, and again, we could easily go 2-3 hours, but I know Eric's dogs are getting hungry, so we better not keep them for much longer. So, we're going to wrap things up here. To end the cast on, then, I just have a few general wrap-up questions. So, the first one is simply, at this point, it's been a few weeks since Rebel Galaxy is out. Have you guys started thinking about what your next project is, or is it still too soon to tell and you're still relaxing from, I think you said, 18 months of developing the game originally?
Yeah, it's too soon to tell. We've still got a bunch of stuff to do on Rebel Galaxy here. We've got to get it working for the console systems. So there's technical things. We're going to get some translations made. And we've got to get some vacation time in.
Yeah.
I think we have a ton of ideas, including a ton of ideas for Rebel Galaxy, but there's no guarantees that's what we'll exactly go to next.
Cool. All right. And I guess my final question then, for the people listening, do you have any final thoughts on any of the topics we discuss, or anything you would like to say to the fans to end the cast on?
I think, I really enjoy watching people's YouTubes. I just keep watch people's Rebel Galaxy YouTubes or Twitch streams on in the background. So I'm appreciative that people keep playing and I can just watch them play because watching people play my game is the coolest thing.
I'm just happy that people are playing at all. Thank you for playing, anybody who played.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. With that, we're going to end things here. Travis, Eric, it's been a pleasure talking to both of you, and I would definitely love to have both of you back on, especially talking more about the ARPG genre, and I know it may be, you know, digging up the past, but I would love to talk more about Hellgate, because that was definitely one of the more interesting times for an ARPG fan.
Sure, it's still a little bit raw, but I think I've moved on far enough, and I'm able to give it a try.
All right. And with that, we're going to end things here. So for those of you listening to the cast, thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options currently available. If you would like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. If you enjoyed the podcast and the content here and would like to help contribute to keeping Game Wisdom going, you can check out our Patreon campaign. That is on the front banner right now, and you can find it on Patreon under Josh Beister or Game Wisdom. Any donations would be greatly appreciated, as I'm trying to hit that first goal real soon. And as we talked about earlier, oh, thank you, Dog. He's supporting it. And as we said earlier, if you'd like to watch plays live or catch AMI recordings, you can find that on the YouTube channel. And you can catch me live on Twitch under GW Beister most nights at 10 Eastern. And there should be links on the front page as well. So again, before we end things, Eric, Travis, it's been great having you on. Thanks so much for doing this. And yeah, definitely don't be strangers, and congratulations with Rebel Galaxy.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Josh.
Yep. And again, for those of you listening, thanks a lot for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.